This is the Apartment Building Investing Podcast with Michael Blank, session number 52. Let's do this.
You're listening to the Apartment Building Investing Podcast, where we'll talk about all aspects of buying apartment buildings with a special focus on raising money from others. And now, your host, Michael Blank.
Hey, and welcome to the show today. Today is going to be all about replacing your income with multifamily investing. And I have with me on the show, Gino Barbero, and he is passionate about multifamily investing, just like I am. He also teaches other people how to do the same, just like I do. And he believes it's all about the strength of your why that determines your success. And he says, you have to decide that you want to change your life. And if you do that, if you truly decide that that's what you want, you have no choice but to take massive action. So the key lesson today is you have to decide and you have to ask yourself, hey, if you want something in life, whatever it may be, have you really decided that that's what you want? And that's what he did several years ago. Gino was in the restaurant business for 22 years, kind of like I was. I wasn't in the restaurant business quite as long, but he grew up in the restaurant business and he was burned out. And there came a point, and he shares this with us in a restaurant, where he decided that he needed to change his life. He couldn't continue doing what he was doing. And he chose real estate as a vehicle for doing it, specifically multifamily. And so in this episode, he chronicles his amazing journey from pizza guy to full-time multifamily investor. And he's had setbacks, misfires, a bad partnership. And he was successful despite having an all-consuming day job at the restaurant. And he partnered up with Jake, and they did their first deal, which was a 25-unit in Knoxville, Tennessee. And today, the two own nearly 700 units, and the sky is literally the limit. The two of them, Jake and Gino, created jakeandgino.com, which is a real estate educational company that offers coaching and training in real estate investing. And he is also the best-selling author of the book, Wilborough Profits. So with that, let's get right into the show. Hey, Gino, welcome to the call today.
Michael, thanks. How you doing?
Hey, man, really good, really good. Glad to have you on the show here. We share a little bit of a similar background, so I'm really excited about delving into that. So just tell us a little bit about yourself and your business.
Michael, the most important thing is that I'm a father of six kids, ranging from 17 to 2. That's my one thing in life. I'll go back to that often, the one thing in life. Second thing is I've been in business since I was 24 years old. So I've never gotten a paycheck from anybody else in my adult career. That's shaped me, my mentality going forward. Personal responsibility is big with me. I started out in the restaurant business. I was in business for about 22 years. I had one business. I could not scale it. Had the limiting belief of not being able to scale it, right? I'm sure you've run up in that in your situation. I just didn't like it. After, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I said, I've got to get out of this. I've got to do something else that I enjoy, that I can make more money, that I can contribute, that I can grow, that I can feel passionate about. And I always tell people, I thank President Obama for coming into office and just keeping this malaise going. I mean, he did a lot of good stuff, but for me, I was always blaming the economy. The economy's wrong. This is wrong. I actually looked inside myself. I said, it's nothing to do with external situations. It's all internal. That's when I went to life coaching school. That's when I met Jake. And that's when I broke out of it. And it took me about three and a half years to start buying. And once I did that, I was able to leave the restaurant. I left the restaurant business this March of this year. So that's a quick synopsis of what's going on my last 20 years of my life.
Yeah, that's so I'm interested in finding more about how you got started with real estate investing. Not so much how, I'll get to that, but more why, right? So you were in a restaurant business. I was in the restaurants business, and I'm like you, almost out of it. You're already out of it. And I'm just wondering, what was it about the restaurant business that kind of said, I don't see myself doing this another 10 years? And how did that thinking start shifting towards real estate?
Last year and a half, my focus has been going towards education. So I've been doing the life coaching. I'm doing a lot of educating. And what I realized, what was happening to me, wrote a blog on this. There's two types of motivation, either moving towards pleasure or away from pain. Now, the guy who's moving towards pleasure, that's what I want to go to now. You're moving towards a vision or a goal, right, Mike? You're going to 1,000 units. My motivation was, I'm moving away from pain, bro. This restaurant's killing me. I'm working on the weekends. I'm working on the holidays. I'm working Thanksgiving, Christmas Eve. I said, I don't like this. And I'm not making the money. So that motivation to move away towards pain really drove me, really motivated me to educate myself, to go on podcasts, to get that queasy feeling I was talking to you about, to get me juiced up, to get me excited. That's what pushed me away from the real estate business. Not as because I wanted to get into real estate and I love buildings and I love doing that. I love the idea of what real estate can afford us and can provide for us. It's just a vehicle to get from point A to point B. And apartments, as you well know, is all about the passive income and creating wealth.
So what was wrong with your restaurant business? You must have sat there one day going, man, this kind of stinks.
the same flip side of that coin is, what made you think of real estate? How did that happen?
Sure. Well, about 10 years ago, my dad passed away. So I was intimately involved with my dad for the first 37 years of my life. I saw him every day. I was in the kitchen with him, old school Italian, work hard, limiting belief. You got to be there. You got to be there all the time. But he was a great mentor to me. So I really, when he passed away, I felt a little void in my life. That's when the restaurant business started turning. You know, about 10 years ago, things started shifting in business with social media, with everything. You either have to start growing in business. And this is true in any business now, more than ever. If you're not growing, you're dying. And I had that one location. It was good for two families 10, 12 years ago, but it cannot support two families now. We're not growing. You have to get on the internet. It's about the brick and mortar plus internet. And my brother didn't want to go that route, and I felt like I was stuck. So when you feel like you're stuck and you're not contributing, you're not growing, you want to get out of that space. And that's what really drew me out of it. And real estate, I had always been investing in real estate unsuccessfully because I had no focus. I had no niche. I was just going around. I had a three-family mobile home park that failed. I had a commercial. I had a little bit of everything, right? And I see you laughing because you feel the pain too, right? But then it just dawned on me. People need a place to live, and this looks like a good space. So what I did is I went to get some coaching, went to Kiyosaki coaching. I had another mentor, and it really opened my eyes. And from there, I decided during that painful and that trial and tribulations, I said, this is where I'm going to start.
You already got started with real estate a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. So you felt like it was at least at a minimum, it would increase some income on the side. Mm-hmm. Were you at the time thinking this was your way out? Is that what you were thinking when you got into real estate, or what was the motivator behind that?
That's funny, because back in 2002, I bought my first triplex, and that wasn't to get out or do anything. I liked the restaurant. I was making good money. I enjoyed it. It was with my brother. It's my mom is there. I said, this is alternate passive income, and it's not really passive, and it's not really great if you're not focusing on it. You really need to focus on it. When we first started, we started part-time, Jake and I. We started growing the portfolio. Then we said all of a sudden, wow, with a limiting belief of we can really do this both full-time. So I didn't start out as trying to go into full-time right away. I just tried to supplement a little bit of income, and you all have that number in your head. I need to have my $5,000 a month, $6,000 a month, $10,000 a month. If I just make that, it'll be okay. And that's the way I was looking at it initially. But then when we started having a little bit of success, I said, well, this can be something turned into something bigger. And that's what eventually happened.
All right. So how did you actually get started? What did you do first? You said you had a little bit of that, a little bit of this. What was some of the stuff that you did early on?
I think the most important thing for people to really take away from this interview is there's no such thing as a mistake. And I've made a lot of mistakes, because mistakes are going to drive you. And that motivating factor of pushing away from the mistake. My first big mistake was at mobile home park. I did no due diligence. I didn't really have any operating agreements, no private placement memorandums. And that investment crapped out, for lack of a better word. It was good for a year, but then after that, the investor was just, he was just not a good person. There's no other way to say it. But it was on me. It was my fault not to get the due diligence, not my fault not to educate myself. And I took that learning experience as I have to learn, and I'm going to use this. Most people would shy away from it. I don't know why. It just lit a fire in me. I said, I know I'm smarter than this. I know I can do better than this. And that's what really catapulted me. And that's when I started to go right to coaching. And I think people really need to get some kind of professional education to really, you know, shorten the learning curve and really follow somebody who's doing something. We're not reinventing the wheel, right, Mike? I mean, people have done it before us. I've learned from other mentors. People teach me. So I go by the learn, do, teach principle. I learned how to do it. I started doing it. I'm pretty successful at it. And now that I'm back, I'm teaching. And teaching is not just about making money. It's about giving back. It's about engaging with people. It's about connecting with people, having communications with people. And that's what really is driving me forward now.
So you didn't have a greatest experience with your mobile home park, but you didn't just dismiss real estate as a bad idea. You just shifted. So what did you shift to from that experience?
From that experience, I went right into coaching. I said, I want to become really successful, and I like apartments. So I said, let me try this apartment thing. I don't want to fix and flip. That's a job. I already was making decent money. I don't want to do this full time. It's not sexy to me knocking down walls. It looks great on TV, but it's a hard business model. It's a real tough business. So I said, let me try apartments. It seems like it's a little more stable. You can do it part time. And you know, that's what we ended up doing. We ended up buying our first 25 unit, and we were doing it part time with our full time jobs. And that's what attracted me. And the cash flow aspect of it, the tax benefits, that's what really attracted me. So then I went into coaching. I got a lot of education on how to buy multis, how to choose a market, how to choose a management company, and that set the stage for me.
Yeah, that's outstanding. So you thought multis was part of the way because it's a little more passive, not as active as flipping houses. Mm-hmm. I do find it interesting that you skipped the single family house landlording step. What did you think about that, and why did you dismiss it?
I just thought it'd be a lot of work to have five or six houses all around. And plus, my market didn't lend to it. My market up here in New York is very expensive. So I can't buy a $42,000 home, rent it for $700 a month. So that was actually a blessing in disguise for me, because my market didn't do it. And I didn't think I could go out of market, because they didn't have turnkey investors back then. Turnkey is basically a new phenomenon in the last 4 or 5 years. They didn't have it back in 06, 07, 08. So I didn't want to start buying singles. What I ended up doing is I ended up going to Rochester, New York, which is about 7 hours out. And I was buying duplexes up there. And they were cash flowing great. It's just that I wanted to scale. And you can't scale with duplexes and tries. You can buy a bunch of them. If you're a property manager or you're a real estate broker or that's your business, it's not a bad model. But if you're an investor, I think the apartment model is so much better for you.
So you did buy some duplexes then. Mm-hmm. Was that kind of your first foray into apartments?
Yes.
And I think that's a big message. And I always try to push people's comfort zone. And I think you do. And we all get the fact that bigger is actually better. But starting with duplexes is not a bad thing. It actually gets you in the game. And that's what I care about. We both care about is getting people to do their first deal. And so you said, hey, instead of me giving up and being overwhelmed by the idea of buying a 25 unit, hey, why don't I just do a duplex? And that's what you did. You started with duplexes in Rochester. Mm-hmm. How many duplexes did you buy? And then what happened after that?
I bought two duplexes up there. That's all. I bought them back about 7 or 8 years ago. And you know what? I didn't scale. I liked it. I would have liked to go on bigger up there, but the market up there is a little difficult. It's actually reemerged now. The University of Rochester is pretty happening. And downtown Rochester, there's just no jobs up there. There's a lot of Section 8. There's a lot of, the taxes are high up there. I didn't really particularly like the market. If you're looking at cash flow and you're looking to hit that financial number, it's a pretty good market to be in. But I just wanted to get that emerging part of the market. I wanted to get that growth, that cap appreciation, and it wasn't up there for me. So I ended up holding them for 5 or 6 years, sold them, didn't lose any money. I did pretty good on them. Got that money and I just reinvested it with Jake and we went down south.
That's pretty cool. Now, at this time you were doing this kind of on the side. It seems to me like you weren't working on a transition plan yet.
Nope.
When did that start happening, that trend, when you said, oh my gosh, I think I'm going to pursue this to actually get out of the restaurant business. When did that happen?
2010/11, I met Jake in the restaurant. He was good friends with my brother. He was working as a pharmaceutical rep in New York. And he said, I'm getting out of New York. I hate the weather, hate the taxes, hate the quality of living. He was living in a one-bedroom apartment. He moves down to Tennessee. He wanted to get into real estate. So I looked on the MLS. I looked on LoopNet. I'm like, wow, $30,000 a unit, $500 a month in rent? This looks great. Then he's telling me it's a right-to-work state, state income tax. It was just people are flocking to that market. The market is expanding. So in 2011, I said, Jake, you want to start investing? I need to make a few dollars more here. So let's start supplementing our income. We formed the partnership in 2010 and 2011. And it took us about a year and a half to find our first deal. He went out and I probably told you before, he bought a house after he made his wife happy. So there was his down payment money, put us back a couple months. Then we ended up buying and we bought our first deal in February of 2013 together.
Tell me a little bit of partnership. And this is always interesting to me. You did not do this alone. Even though you were already investing on your own and Jake maybe was doing stuff on his own as well. Why did you guys decide to partner up?
I think partnerships get a bad rap from a lot of people. It all depends who you partner with. If you partner with somebody who's just like you, me and him are very similar. We do this, we say we're going to do. He likes to say make it happen. He's a very energetic guy. He's a very ethical person. We have very similar goals. We both want to provide for our families. We both want to create generational wealth. We both want to be, I don't say leaders, but we both want to be striving to do something that we both really enjoy doing. And that really helped us. And I'll give you an example of how partnerships work so well. I was talking to you before. We just put in an offer on a property. Big deal. We're going to syndicate $60 million, right? Got that nervous stomach. He calls me up and he's all worked up. And it's great when you have a partner because you can bounce ideas off that partner and that partner can calm you down and make you see something that you don't see. And he's like, thanks. I'm glad I had to call you. I'll call you right back. So partnerships, there's two minds are better than one. And Jake's mind put together might make one full mind, if you see what I'm saying. But you get so many great ideas. You get a great support there. You have more capital. Your balance sheet is stronger with two guys. I just love partnerships, to be honest with you. I've had a partnership with my brother for the last 20 years. I've had a bad one, the mobile home park, but I don't want to have that limiting belief where you have something go wrong in life and you're going to assume for the rest of your life that's what's going to happen. That's not how life works. You make that mistake, you learn from it, and you try to, shift gears.
So you and Jake have dabbled in smaller real estate. You've done some duplexes. You guys got together. You shared a common vision. What did you guys do from that point on? You talked about your first deal. Let's talk about that. What was your action plan from the time you guys said, okay, let's do this until your first deal? Kind of what happened here? What were you doing?
The very first thing we did was I was the one who had a little bit more education in the beginning. Jake was the one with the energy and the drive, and he was living in the market. So basically, we were fortunate that he was living in an emerging market. What Jake ended up doing is he ended up going out, meeting brokers. We're trying to get network relationships. And like I said, it took us a year. People wanted us to sign exclusivity agreements. I'm like, Jake, we're not signing exclusive with a broker because we're going to be locked in with him. People are telling us you're never going to do business down here. And your first deal is very difficult, right? Because you have no credibility. So what I ended up doing is I ended up designing my credibility book where I put in my duplexes, I put in my triplex, my restaurant. I tried to show the banks how we were credible, how we had a business plan. Even if you don't have assets, formulate a business plan. And our business plan is very simple. We buy mom and pop underperforming assets where we can add value. They're B and C properties. They're from 50 to 150 units. Formulate your business plan, show your partner, your investor, your banker, how you're going to return that money. It's important for them to see, you know, what kind of credibility you have. Even if you don't own anything, if you can talk the game and you can walk the walk, they will take you seriously.
So Jake was down, where's Tennessee, Kentucky? Where was he?
Knoxville, Tennessee.
Knoxville. So he was down there, which was an emerging market. So he was the one, he was creating deal flow. And so you guys were, it took you about a year and a half to do a deal. How many deals did you look at before you did that first deal?
We looked at several. I mean, it's not a huge market. You really
it's not a huge market.
You have to make the broker relationships. That's the key thing down south. It's not an MLS market where they're going to throw stuff on MLS. And people are like, that never doesn't really work. You need to create relationships with brokers. You need to show them that they're really that you're really credible. We just got a deal that we're closing at the end of the month. It's 100 units. Didn't hit the market. Brokers don't want to waste money on advertising. They don't want to waste money on time. They want to know they have a sure thing. And if you can provide all that for them, they're going to hold those deals until they vet out all their potential buyers. And then once that goes, it goes right onto MLS or onto LoopNet. So you need to form relationships with brokers. I think that's the most important thing. We didn't have that in the beginning. We got a little lucky. We found the broker who was really knowledgeable. He knew about owner financing and he helped us out. And we created a great relationship with him and we bought the next four or five deals through him.
Let's talk about that first deal. You obviously found it through a broker. You know, just tell us a little bit about that deal.
It was really what we call the ultimate mom and pop. It was a 25-unit deal. Had a lot of problems. It was on LoopNet for $750. It was on there for 2 or 3 years, long time. Nobody was bidding it for it, right? And that's what happens when things become stale. It's great because you know they're motivated. So in any real estate deal, for you to make money, you need to have a motivated seller. That's what I tell everybody. You need motivated sellers for owner financing or just to not buy at retail. These two were an older couple. They were the ultimate, you know, motivated sellers. They wanted to get out. They wanted to retire. So we, at 25 units, we offered them $600,000, 80% bank financing, 10% owner financing, and 10% down payment. So we had to come out of pocket about $80,000 for this first deal.
But wait a second now. They were asking $750,000 and you offered $600,000. That's crazy.
Yes.
And the thing has been on the market for 2 years. So really, they can't have been that motivated. But for some reason, at that point, they started becoming motivated.
I think what happens is people are afraid of lowballing. There's no such thing as a lowball offer. If you come in with the right numbers, I came in with the right analysis and the right numbers. There was a mom and pop because they had different numbers all commingled in their funds. You weren't sure what they were doing. When we did the closing, it was a weekly rental. Jake had to go knock on the door and ask him, what's your name? And collect rents that way the very first month. They had no systems. So, I mean, we probably overpaid. We probably could have paid $550 for the property, but we were so thrilled to get into that first deal. And you always talk about it. Get into that first deal. We had crappy terms. A 5.5% interest rate was about a point higher. We had a 20-year AM, which should have been a 25-year AM. And we had a 5-year term. I would have liked 7 years, but that's what we got. So got us in. Fortunately, we worked the property for 2.5 years. We got it refied last year in August. It was actually appraised for $800,000. So we were able to extract $180,000 out. We only put down $80,000. We were able to pull out $180,000. So that first mistake lends to an amazing opportunity, right?
Yeah, let's talk about it. I mean, it sounds to me like this was not a home run deal. This was like maybe a base hit, if at all. You could say it wasn't really that great. It wasn't like a crazy value add deal either, right? Sounds like it was a partial value add because it was mismanaged.
There was a lot of little value adds. They were paying cable. So we were paying cable for the tenants because it was the weekly renters. And they thought that if we don't pay them cable, we're not going to be able to have these tenants. So what we ended up doing is we ended up going to monthly tenants. We got rid of a lot of the tenants slowly but surely. So we repositioned the tenant base. That's the first thing. We stabilized the income. There was a lot of little cottages on this property, 2-bedroom cottages. There was a 6-plex. There was a couple, 4 duplexes on the property. So a lot of little different stuff going on. Storage sheds that were empty. We actually cleaned them up. We started renting them out for storage. We started making people pay for their electric. They weren't paying for the electric. So there's a lot of little value adds. We increased the revenue and those costs that they had every time turning over a unit cost a ton of money. So we started screening, you know, using applications to actually get a better tenant base. And after 6 months, the mail lady actually said to us, which is one of the nicest compliments we've had, she goes, I can actually feel safe delivering mail here now. So it's not just about making money. It's about creating a better community, creating affordable places for people to live that can't afford to live in a nice place, you know?
Now, were you guys self-managing at this point, or did you bring in a project manager at one point?
We're still self-managing. We have almost we're going to have almost 800 units, and we've built a management company. So what our goal was to really, you know, control this asset, but Jake wanted to be in the trenches. We wanted to learn. I think the first deal, if you can, it's always better to self-manage yourself, see how things go, try to build your systems out. And then if you want to, pass it off to a management company so you can at least tell them how you want it run. I think that's probably the best. That's what was the best thing for me, because I had managed my stuff. So I already knew how to tell Jake, listen, this is what we have to do. This is how we have to manage a property. So I already had the experience. And, you know, I think Jake liked it so much that he just kept managing it. And now we've got about 20 employees. So, I mean, we're totally ingrained in the business.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, but you said it took you guys about a year and a half to do that first deal.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And then when you did that deal, it wasn't like this crazy home run, and it was actually listed on LoopNet, right?
Mm-hmm, yep.
So for people who are saying, man, you know, I can't find that smoking hot deal. Come on, you don't need a smoking hot deal, right? Especially your first one. You just don't want to lose your shirt, right? But the value of that first deal is much more than any kind of money you're going to make on it. In this case, even if you let time pass, you guys tweaked this thing, made it better over time, and you're raised, you know, $250,000 in equity on that thing, which is extraordinary. It took a long time to do that first deal. And then when and where and how did the second one happen?
Shortly thereafter, we found another 36-unit property, all one bedrooms, about 10 minutes from our property in July of that year. So 5 months later, we're in our second deal. We purchased our second deal. We brought on another partner for that. So there's four of us now, my brother, partner, Jake, and myself. We got into our second deal. Was it hard to get into it? It was. It was tricky. We learned a lot of stuff on there. The bank terms weren't the greatest. We're fumbling around. But the property is doing $10,500 a month in revenue. That was 3 years ago. We're at 18 grand a month in revenue. So you can see the value adds that were instituted there. We were able to refi that property, also pull all our money out. So, I mean, that deal ended up being great also. It's in a path of progress where there's a bridge that's reopened down there. It's close to the University of Tennessee. So, hey, down the road, we might be able to reposition this from a C to an A property. We don't know. But the sky's the limit. It's all paid off now. I mean, as far as getting our capital back, and it's cash flowing every month.
That's fantastic. So just to skip over a few details, the first deal, it was you and Jake, and you guys came up with the $80,000. You got the other $80,000 from seller financing. Very, very clever. You got a low price and seller financing. So you made the deal happen. The second one, you brought in two additional people. One is your brother, and then some other person.
Yep.
And how did you recruit your brother? I can see, hey, I kind of like Gino. He's a pretty good guy. I kind of know him. And what about the other person?
Well, this is what's funny. I'm in a chef coat. I'm still working at the restaurant. I see my partner, who's my partner now in the business, come in, and he's talking to him about China and about the economy. I think I threw him for a loop because he's like, what's this pizza guy talking about China and about inflation and interest rates? So I said to him, I said, listen, I've got like 70 units down south. You do any real estate investing? We just started talking. We started building rapport, and I had already known him for years, but I think, like I said, he was unaware of my real estate. A couple months later, got in touch with him. I said, you want to invest with us? So he invested with us in the second deal. And he's been an integral part. He's been more like a mentor to me because he's a very intelligent guy. You know, he's got money, he's got the assets, but he knows how to run the business. He knows how to handle income. He knows how to handle the expenses. He's just a very savvy investor.
That's fantastic.
You never know. You're slinging pizzas. You never know what you're doing. You can't make that excuse. And that was one thing that was holding me back. I'm like, I'm in a chef court. How am I going to, you know, meet people? How am I going to shake and bake and do deals? And you never know what God puts in front of you. And this guy was just sitting there. I'll never forget it. And I think that was what gave me, you know, the fortune to do this. Cause right after that in July, February the following year, we got into 136 units. So the progression was 25, 36, then 136. And I credit him a lot with that because he had the balance sheet coupled with mine and Jake's. Plus he had a little bit more money to put down. Plus he lent us a little bit money to get into the deal. And we bought the deal for $4 million. And that's another one that was listed at $6.3 million on LoopNet. I offered $3.7 million. And I thought, this guy's going to laugh at me. He dropped his price to $4.4 in one shot. So you never know. If you go into a negotiation with your numbers, you go in prepared and you show them a written offer of why you're offering what you're offering, they can't laugh at you. They can only say, I'm sorry. But this guy dropped the price, and to go from 4.4 to 4.075, it took 2 months. To go from 6.3 to 4.4, it took 2 minutes. So you have to be persistent. You have to be patient, persistent, but willing to walk away.
That's a good lesson. So you have to be persistent, and you know, you have to make a lot of offers. But also the other thing you're doing, this is very important for the listeners, is you're not just making an offer, you're explaining your offer, right? Can you talk a little bit more about what you do there?
Sure. Well, what we try to do is at the time, 3 or 4 years ago, we're looking at properties at an ACAP. We buy properties on actual numbers. So you give me the last 12 months of your profit and loss statements. We know now what it costs to run an apartment in our market. It costs about $3,600 per unit to run. So we see if these guys are running at $2,600 a month, we're not using their number because it's not, the banks are going to laugh at that also. The banks have instructed us what the number is. If they're running them at $4,500, that's a huge value play. We love that. So we buy it at an actual net operating income number. We're buying an actual ACAP, 10% cash on cash return, and we're hoping that the debt coverage ratio was about 1.3. And that one came out about 3.839. So we overpaid a touch, but the amount of value that we put into this property, the property was only generating $53,000 a month in revenue when we took over it's going to be 3 years in February. Within the first year, we had revenue up to $80,000 a month. And now this last month, we hit $92,000 a month in revenue because there's other we built back for utility. We had laundry income. They were vastly underrented. They were underrented at like $450 a month. We took over and now they're renting for $625 a month, these two bedrooms plus rubs. And also you have to understand, mom and pops, they were using 5 out of the 136 units as storage sheds. So those 5 units were down, right? They weren't using them. So we wanted rent-ready units. So they actually prepared those rent-ready units and they were renting them so low. I don't know why. They were just like, Jake likes to call it the death spiral. These are the type of landlords that were like, don't call me, don't bother me. Anything breaks, your rent is so much. And that's what happened. You start doing that over the entire platform and the revenue drops. So if you're buying on an actual number, that's what you're looking for. You need to buy them on actual numbers. And it gets a little bit harder now because you're getting pushback because the market is sort of inflating now. But banks are going to want to see actual numbers. They're going to want to see actual expenses. So you have to get those numbers and base your income and your offer on those numbers.
Yeah, that's great advice. What other advice do you have for think back before you did your first deal? I think you talked about putting your credibility packet together. Mm-hmm. And it was the two of you guys, and you were struggling a little bit trying to get broker's attention because you hadn't done a deal yet. What are some of the things that you did to convince that one broker, you know, to kind of take you seriously?
Well, let me step back even quicker, farther than that. I think the first thing that everyone on this call has to do is you have to focus on a market. So focus on that. Don't focus on deals. If you want to learn how to analyze deals, it's one thing, but focus on a specific market. Then when you find that market you like, whether it's, and we have all stuff on about it, whether it's about, you know, job growth, population growth, demographics of the market, pick that market, then go into the market and start looking at deals in the market. And I think that's what a lot of people do wrong. And that's what I did wrong. I was looking in Florida. I was looking upstate New York. I was all over the place in the beginning. But when I decided to say Knoxville, Tennessee is where I'm going to start, let me start there. And it doesn't mean that I have to stay there. It means learn that market intimately, start doing deals there, start building a team there, and then from there, go to another market. And that's what happened. We didn't build our team on the first deal as much as quickly as we should have. We didn't have the inspector on. We didn't have a title company on. We didn't have the bank on. Fortunately, the bank that held the bank financing, gave us the financing, was the bank that held the note on this property. So that made things a little bit easier for us. But try to get your ducks in a row before you start. And you know how you take people seriously? It's all how you talk and how you build rapport. Sound like you're in real estate. Sound like you know what a cap rate is. Because a lot of commercial brokers don't know a lot of this lingo. But if you do and you can present to them, I have something about 45 questions. If you can ask these questions to a broker and get answers, you're going to look like you know what you're talking about. What are the expenses? Where's the path of progress? I mean, how much does it cost per unit to run? What are the rents for a two-bedroom? All these questions you have to intimately know before you make contact with these brokers. So once you start talking to them, you're going to be able to, you know, sound like a pro.
Yeah, that's outstanding. So where are you with the business today and kind of what are your goals moving forward?
We, like I said, we currently own about 800 units. We're going to be closing on the 100 by the end of the year. After listening to you on your podcast, after having you on, the syndication light bulb went off on me. I said, you know, I never wanted to deal with syndication and deal with investors, but the only way we're going to be able to scale the business, because we've been repurposing our funds. So this is all our funds repurposing from refinancing properties, re-putting it back in. And we've been able to do it in about 3.5 years, which has been pretty quick. But I'm sure if we had done a syndication, we'd be a lot bigger. But it's not only about just being bigger. It's about being better, being more efficient, being able to return the capital to the partners and being able to grow sensibly. Because right now we're building out the management company. We're trying to make it like a franchisable model where we're going to be able to take this and say, hey, if we want to go to another market and we're not self-managing it, this is what we want our management company to do. I think that's very important because that's often overlooked. I mean, we talk about the three frameworks. We talk about buy right, manage right, and finance right. Once you buy the property right and once you got the financing going, the manage right is a constant wheel of the wheelbarrow that's constantly going. So we're focusing on getting better on managing right. And I think we'd like to start syndicating next year. I think that's where the next step is.
So you talk about kind of a light bulb going off on syndication a little bit. Did you have any other kind of aha moment that you can think of?
You know, back when I was working, I'm back in the shed at the restaurant, putting away the groceries and the stuff. And I got Jay calling me and we're negotiating on the 281 units deal we did last year in August. It's 281 units. We did an $11 million deal, 20% owner financing. We didn't put any money down in this deal, right? And he's on the phone talking to me and I'm negotiating this huge deal. And I turn to myself, I say to myself, what the heck am I doing putting away groceries and putting away these pizza boxes, right? I said to myself, what am I doing? And it's hard to come to that realization of your time should be well spent on generating revenue, not on doing these $6 an hour mundane tasks. And that's when it really hit me. I almost threw the phone on the ground. I just want to start crying because I said to myself, I'm wasting my time and I've been just like wasting my life on doing these things I shouldn't be doing. But it just took me that point to get to that point. And once I did that deal, I said, that's it. I'm out of the restaurant. So it took a long time for me to get there. Some people never get there. It took me long, but I mean, I think you could probably relate to that, right?
Well, you know, you've spent many, many years in the restaurant business. It's number one, it's what you're used to, you're comfortable in doing. And it's very difficult to number one, distance yourself from, to become uncomfortable. Number one, your ego is such a stranglehold on what you did. And so you're essentially saying, I'm throwing all that away. Mm-hmm. I can't throw it all away. What a waste that would be if I threw it out the window.
And it's funny you say that because that was my identity. My identity was wrapped around my business. Sure. And that's not who I am. I'm a dad. I got six kids. That's who I really am. But I thought my identity was that. And now that I see people from the restaurant, they don't even understand. They don't even know that I'm doing real estate. They don't have no idea what my portfolio is. And they always associate me with the restaurant. And it's like you said, it was very difficult to distance yourself because like you said, people, I think, have a fear of failing. And I think I had that fear of failing also, but that's what motivated me more. So anybody out there who's very afraid of failing, if you're that afraid of failing, think about moving away from that pain and going towards that pleasure and use that as a motivating factor to drive you to do better and to educate yourself more and to surround yourself with people who are smarter and better than you are.
Yeah, I think most of us are motivated by pain, right? That's mm-hmm. the strongest motivator, clearly. And I see even my own students, the ones that are motivated by pain are just more motivated than the ones who are trying to just move towards gain. But it's kind of a shame, right? Because why do we need to go through pain first? It's just mm-hmm. a strong motivator. But we can sit here and decide that we want to move towards gain and we can be just as motivated. I just find it very interesting that pain is a stronger motivator.
You know why? You can ask 10 people, what do you want? I guarantee you 9 of them will tell you what they don't want. So this is another thing for everyone out there. Think of what you want, because what you want is going to focus on, you know, we always think, I say, what do you want to do for a living? Well, I don't want to work at the restaurant. That's what I came up with. But that's not what I'm asking myself. What do I really want? I really want to get out of this and make money and create that passive income. So from there, you start asking better questions, you're going to get better answers. And that's what happened to me. So that's really important. Focus on what you want, what you don't want.
So you learned a lot in your life. If you could travel back in time and have a conversation with your younger self, what would you tell yourself?
I wrote an article about this. What would I tell myself if I was 30, when I was 30 years old? And I think that I'm from a business perspective, so I have a business mindset. I would have told myself to get out of the rat race, become financially independent, because once you can do that, you can do anything you want in life. You can choose to be anything you want in life. I feel sorry for these millennials that are coming out. They're an incredible age bracket. They're incredible people, but they're saddled with a lot of this debt and they have problems coming out, and it's not their fault. They have to get an education. That's what they're told. So they're coming out with $100,000 in debt. They've got a mortgage payment before they even have a mortgage, before they even have a house. So I would love to see young people in their 20s and 30s just got that financial freedom number they got. Then once they have that, they can choose to do whatever they want. It's a powerful motivator. And I wish I had learned that sooner. I would have gotten out sooner, but I just unfortunately didn't do that. So I think that's the lesson for all you guys out there, all you young guys. Focus on getting out of that rat race, not being a traffic fighter, as Alex Becker says, and focusing on what you want to do once you hit that financial number.
Yeah, it's great advice, and it's something I'm trying to do with my kids. And I was never surrounded by entrepreneurs when I grew up. I was 35 before I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I am a total entrepreneur, totally. I mean, if I look back at my life, through that lens, I like, oh my gosh, I did that because I wanted to come out, you know, but I didn't. I just, I just didn't know. And it's very similar. I mean, we have a lot of things broken today, and college education is one of them. Mm-hmm. And man, how do you address that? And I think one way, not everyone is meant to be an entrepreneur. I don't even want to say that, but we should at least expose our young, the kids and the teenagers to building your own business. Because if they can do that at a much earlier age, how powerful could that be?
Mm-hmm. I think we all have the entrepreneurial in us if we're raised properly. I think we all want to strive. You know, we all have to be able to sell ourselves. It's not just going into business, but you can be an entrepreneur within an organization, create value for that organization, and rise up within that organization. We all have that ability to. I think everyone has the idea of an entrepreneur being a gunslinger, going out there and making millions of bucks and taking all the risk. And I don't think that's what a true entrepreneur is. I think a true entrepreneur is somebody who makes enough money to learn from their mistakes, which is A, I did that, right? And B, adding value, whether it's to your customers through your products, whether it's through your, you know, education through your students, or whether it's adding value to the company you work for.
Yeah, totally agree. So what advice, do you have for the new investor who aspires to get into multifamily, or just to make general to get out of the rat race? What would you tell that person?
Well, let's go specifically in real estate. First thing I would do is I would say, get enough reasons why. You have to write down why you want to do something, whether it's losing weight, whether it's opening a new business, whatever it is. You have to find out the reasons why. If you have enough powerful reasons why, you're going to figure out how you're going to do it. That's the first thing. You got to have enough passion and enough motivation, enough drive behind it. If not, it's going to fizzle out. Your thought leads to your desires, which lead to your actions, which lead to your results. Remember that. Thought. And then once you have a big desire, that desire comes within you. That desire is going to lead to any kind of action. You have to take massive action. And from that massive action, your end results show up. It might take you a year, might take you 2 years, might take you 3 years. But if you go down that path, you'll definitely get those results you're looking for. The second thing is focus on a market. Start focusing on markets. Start getting educated. You need to get out there, start reading books, listening to podcasts, getting on Bigger Pockets, listening to Michael's show, listening to my show. Start surrounding yourself with guys who do it. You don't have to physically know us, but if you listen to us every day and you get that motivation and you get the good stuff going into your ears instead of all this negative stuff on TV, you're going to start growing. You're going to start seeing the possibilities. Then start just going out there and just start learning the business, and then just start taking risks. And you know what? You're going to get that queasy feeling in your stomach. As I talked to Michael before, if you get that queasy feeling in your stomach, that means it's a good thing. You're doing something that you feel uncomfortable. The more uncomfortable you can feel in life, the better off your life is going to be. That's just no two ways about that. If you feel like you're having a comfortable life, like I did in the restaurant business 10, 12 years ago, it's going to get boring. You're going to be unsatisfied. Step out of the comfort zone, start doing it. And like Michael said, start small if you have to. That duplex, what Jake wanted to do is he wanted to buy a duplex, live on one side, rent the other side out. And I think that's such an awesome strategy for a lot of places, because you can have your mortgage paid, you can have your taxes paid, and bam, you got a tenant living there and you can live rent free, and that will get you started.
Yeah. So you talked about your why is very, very important. And, I talk to people and I say, what are your goals? I want to have 1,000 units. I say, great. Why? And what I'm finding is there are a lot of people who say, I want to be a millionaire. I want to quit my job, but they don't actually do anything after that conversation. And it always puzzles me. You're telling me you want one thing, but you don't do the other.
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain that? And more importantly, how can you get someone to take action?
Okay. I think I can explain that, because what I just talked about with the thoughts, we all have thoughts in our mind, right? But if they're not a burning desire, those thoughts just dissipate into the air. They have to become a burning desire. Like I said, you're moving away from something. My burning desire after 4 years was just, I got to get out of this. So my desire became so powerful. The next step is to take that massive action. And you know what massive action can be for one person is for another. And my massive action was, listen, I did 2 coaching programs. I spent a lot of money on my education. I crapped on a couple of deals. I met Jake. I got out of my comfort zone, going into a different market. I got out of my comfort zone, hooking up with a partner. Those are all massive action steps, right? Even starting a podcast, even starting for the education, these are all big steps. And let me tell you, you're never good at anything, right? You have to learn how to crawl before you learn how to walk, before you learn how to, really run or jog or whatever. You have to have that progression. We always think of being at the top of a mountain. Well, enjoy the climb. And that was my problem. I didn't enjoy the climb. I was going up towards the mountain. I could only see the mountain, envision the mountain. I could never really enjoy the climb up. That's one thing we have to do in life, is let's enjoy the climb up to the mountain. Let's not always worry and say about, when I get there. You're already successful. You're already going for it. You're already doing it. That's what success to me is all about, is actually getting out and doing it.
Yeah, I think you said that burning desire is so key. I think I want to simplify it even more. I think it's a decision. It's when a person decides, is when all of a sudden their life changes. And a decision is a very authentic thing, because you can always tell when someone has decided something, because it's always followed by massive action. Mm-hmm. If someone really decides they want to lose weight or quit, if someone really decides, all of a sudden they magically are able to do it. And it's mm-hmm. only because they actually really decided. When someone tells me they want to quit the rat race and they buy my program and don't do anything, they actually haven't decided they want to change their life. They just said they want something, but they haven't decided it. And there's a Tony Robbins quote that I love. It's in a moment of decision that your destiny is shaped, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this before. I never really thought about it until recently. I was like, you know, it's the decision. When you really decide something, honestly decide, you have to take action. There's nothing logical that happens after that. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it with people repeatedly, even my own brothers and sisters who have had a certain life and they've gone and done a certain thing. All of a sudden something changed. And I was like, why did your life all of a sudden change so quickly? So, well, and they would tell it, and they use the word decided a lot. And when I interview people, I even actually use the word decide when you're in the, yeah, I decided, I decided this. When you really decide something, it's just fascinating that you can only take massive action after that.
Do you mind if I give you an example of what you're talking about?
No, by all means.
My dad was a smoker, started smoking when he was 9 years old in Italy, cigarette here and there. So he smoked his whole life. This got to be maybe in his 50s, goes to a doctor, tried to stop this and that, goes to his doctor. Doctor says, if you don't stop smoking in 6 months, you're going to get emphysema, you're going to die. The next day, my dad decides to go to a chiropractor. Never went to a chiropractor before. He stopped smoking in one day. Now, he attributes it to the chiropractor. I think he attributes it to if I don't stop tomorrow, I'm dead, right? We're always thinking into the future. You know what? It'll never happen or happen. But when you get that wake-up call, and like you said, he decided that he'd rather live than have his – he saw his dad with emphysema and oxygen tanks. He's like, I ain't going down that road. He made that decision. I mean, smoking is a powerful thing to stop, right?
Very difficult, right?
It's really difficult. But if you don't decide to you know, cut yourself from being a smoker, and that decision came from, I have to do it or else I'm going to die. It's either continue to smoke and die or quit and lead a more fruitful life. And that's what happened to him. And that's what I think has to happen to a lot of people when they have life-altering moments. Because when you get into real estate, your life is going to shift. It's going to shift for the better if you follow through on it. So if you're comfortable, you're doing something, you have to make that decision. That light bulb has to go off. Like I said to you, I'm in the shed. It has to go off to you and go, wow, I got to do this. And then, like you said, click.
Yeah, if your life is pretty good, why change it?
That's right.
I mean, I have this conversation all the time. Hey, you got a pretty good job, got a nice house, nice family. Why in the world do you want to start multifamily investing? I mean, honestly. And then, you know, and their actions reflect that.
That's
because
right.
You're right. Their life isn't so bad. Mm-hmm. So there's really no reason to change it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I've also had people who had pretty good lives and they've decided that this is not something they want to do for the next 10 years. They like their job, but they don't see themselves doing what they're doing. And even though their life is pretty good, nevertheless, for some reason, they take massive action. And that is because they decided that they want something different. And it's just fascinating. The people who don't take action, in my opinion, I'm not an expert, but it appears to me that they have not decided that they want something.
Mm-hmm. This is from Tony Robbins. He talked about the six human needs. So the six human needs are, we need connection. We need to be connected with people. We need to be certain. We need to be uncertain. We need to have connection. We need to have significance and love. Those are the first four fundamental. The fifth and the sixth are the growth and the contribution. Those five and six is what gets people into multifamily or gets people into another endeavor, whether it's charity. We're always looking as humans to grow. So if we're not growing, we're dying. And if we're not contributing back and giving back, there's something about giving back and helping other people, that really lights the fire. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, it's great to make money in education, right? But isn't it awesome when a guy comes to you and says, I could have never done this without you? I mean, I love life coaching. I mean, it's the most powerful thing when you let people open up and let them get into that space where they can talk about themselves and they can come to that realization. That's why life coaching is great, because you have that space where you can talk to somebody and talk about your fears and talk about your goals and talk about your aspirations in a great environment and let say, okay, this is what I really want to do. And I think those last two human needs really is what propels people to go forward.
Yeah, totally agree. We're gonna wrap things up here. Is there any kind of favorite books that you've read recently that you recommend?
Reading a book right now called The One Thing. I've read it, reading it a second time. I love the book because it.
I just read it recently myself.
Right.
It's in a top three now, yeah, actually.
Right. I mean, everyone talks about Rich Dad, Poor Dad. That's a great book.
That's number one, of course.
Yeah. That's the why, right? That's not the how. That's the why. And I think we have to get into that right mind shift and mindset of why. And he's been on target for the last 20 years talking about your house is not an asset and all this. And he's talking about the financial education. He's true about that. But I think The One Thing is great because it makes you focus on that one thing in life. Chunk it down, what's important, and go after that thing. And that's what I've been focusing on the last year, and it's brought me success.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book. How appreciate it. What's the best way for people to find you?
We have a website, jakeandgino.com. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We have Jake's got a Snapchat account. I'm on LinkedIn. We're all over the place. So, social media is great with us, but just go check out our site. We've got a lot of articles, got a bunch of podcasts. We have a podcast on iTunes called Wheelbarrow Profits, and you can hit us up there.
Yeah, you guys have fantastic multifamily and general real estate resources. So appreciate what you guys are doing to educate the masses. I do share your passion for teaching. It's something I discovered a little late in life, and I just really love it. And I do think that multifamily is the best real estate strategy out there to actually quit the rat race. So really appreciate your time and sharing your story with us.
Thanks, Mike. I had a great time today. And like, you know, all the listeners, find out why. If you have enough reasons why, you're going to figure out how. And the how is either come to Mike or come to me and we'll help you out. Right, Mike?
That sounds good. All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mike. Take care.
All right. Today's lesson clearly was, for me, decision point. All right. It all comes down with you deciding what you want, not saying what you want and telling everybody that you want to be a millionaire, quit your job and do this stuff. You really have to decide. You have to honestly decide that you want to change your life. And if you're honest about that, you're sincere about that, and you have decided, the universe has no choice but to give you the reality that you've decided you already want. And it sounds hokey, but I've seen it over and over again I've experienced it myself, but I've seen it with others as well. And it all comes down to that decision point. Truly decide what you want to experience, and the reality will follow. Because when you decide that you want something, truly decide, it's automatically followed by massive action. And the universe literally aligns itself to give you what you've decided you want. And if you don't take massive action, then it is a strong sign that you actually haven't decided. So if you say you want to do something and you're not following through on something, that you have to go back to that decision point, because you may not have made that decision. Because if you truly decide, just like Gino said on the show with his dad quitting smoking, he decided right then and there he was going to do it. He didn't have to go through weeks, months, and years of, you know, withdrawal and classes and stuff like that. And that's because he decided that was the end of it. And it's the same thing with you in real estate investing. Once you decide that you want to change your life with real estate, it's always followed by massive action. Anyway, I hope you're inspired by Gino's story. And show notes, by the way, are going to be at themichaelblank.com/session52. That's T-H-E, themichaelblank.com/session52. And while you're there, make sure you download my free ebook called The Secret to Raising Money to Buy Your First Apartment Building. And there's two ways you can do it. One is you can go to themichaelblank.com. That's T-H-E, Michael, and then B-L-A-N-K, themichaelblank.com, and download it there. Or you can get it via text message, which is totally cool. The way you do it is you text the word secret book. So it's secret book, all one word, no spaces. And you text that to 44222. It's 44222. You text the word secret book to 44222, and then you just respond back with an email, and I'll send it to that email. Really easy to do if you're on the go, you're in the car, listen to this podcast or whatever. So make sure you grab that book. I appreciate you. I'll catch you in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Apartment Building Investing Podcast with Michael Blanc. For more free podcasts, articles, and videos, go to themichaelblanc.com. There, you can also download the free ebook, The Secret to Raising Money to Buy Your First Apartment Building. Till next time.